We have an hour and a half of robust debate ahead of us. I know that many of you come to this every year, so you know the form. I would like not to have to interrupt you from the floor, so if you have a comment to make or a question, please feel free, but please avoid making long-winded speeches of one kind or another. That really helps the evening go with a bit of a bang. So let's introduce our panel to you. Leslie Carroll is a Presbyterian minister from North Belfast, the parish of Fort William and Macquarie. Previously a member of the Victims and Survivors Forum and sat on the Eames-Bradley Consultative Group on the past. She's been very involved in reconciliation. She said, nobody will listen to you unless they sense you like them. If a person senses you don't like them, your religion and political views will seem all wrong. So, Leslie, welcome to you.
Thanks, Noel.
Yeah. John O'Dowd, Minister of Education since 2011. His finest hour was acting as Deputy First Minister when Martin McGuinness was on the presidential trail. He's been an MLA since 2003, and he's spoken of his political defining moment being the hunger strikes. He has a lot of difficult issues on his desk as Education Minister. I'm sure some of them will come up this evening. Danny Kennedy, his finest hour was being chosen by Slugger O'Toole as the best committee chairman in 2008 for his work on the committee scrutinising the OFM-DFM.
What an honour.
Well, I know. Joined the Ulster Unionist Party in 1974, has been an MLA since 1998 and Minister for Regional Development since 2011. Tim Bartlett, will need no introduction to most of you. Finest priest of his generation, he tells me.
Oh.
No, I'm only joking. We were laughing earlier about his description on one of the other failure things he was involved in, which says something like that.
My mother wrote.
He modestly denies it all. He's Secretary of the Catholic Commission on Social Affairs and Secretary to the Catholic Bishops in Northern Ireland. He's spoken of the greatest dilemma for Christians in contemporary politics being willing to stand up, or are they willing to stand up against the crowd of popular opinion or party policy for what is right, good, noble and true. Pat Buckley says you should be a bishop yourself. I don't know whether you take that as a recommendation or not, but I'm sure it was meant in the best possible form. So that's our panel. Ladies and gentlemen, round of applause. Now, there is no agenda here tonight. I have no list of questions, no list of plants. We have no idea what's going to come up. What I would ask you to do, ladies and gentlemen, well, I guess we've got a fair idea what's got to come up in some form or other. But if you would just, if you want to speak, put up your hands. Yeah, and I'll try and get around as many of you as I can. We have two people on the floor with roving microphones. Let's start in the front row, a very good place to start. Gentlemen in the green shirt.
Thank you very much. My name is Fred Hughes and I'm a director of Palestine Aid, a registered charity. I live in the Cave Hill Road, so I'm very pleased to see Leslie here tonight. I'd like to know how all the pro-Palestinian activists and humanitarians try and engage with the unionist community and through the unionist Protestant churches to get the people who are empathetic on the unionist side for the Palestinians, because it appears that loyalism is hijacking the cause of Israel and stopping members of the unionist community from showing empathy and support for Palestine.
Well, there are a number of assumptions there, Fra, but let's ask Danny Kennedy how he thinks that the loyalist stroke unionist, what do they call them, the PUL community, can be a horrible new acronym which has come about in the last couple of years, but how do you engage the PULs in the Palestinian cause?
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Thanks, Fra, for the question, and thanks for the invitation to our host tonight. Genuinely pleased to be with you here tonight in West Belfast at this very fine educational establishment. I want to congratulate the principal and the teaching staff and all the staff for their many fine achievements here.
And, Danny, I must say, for the shiniest floor
terribly good.
In the entire world.
Very good. It's normally politicians who court popularity with comments like that, but anyway, Noel, you're learning. The issue of, I mean, I don't think I can accept your assumption that loyalism has somehow hijacked sort of pro-Israeli, anti-Palestinian viewpoint. I think a great many people may say that, you know, Sinn Féin and Republicans, because of their close affinity with Palestinians, have blurred some of the issues around that. I think all of us would want to see the continuation of the present ceasefire that exists in Gaza. That we need to work through the issues that are there. It's an even older and more historic, I think, quarrel than our own. If you go right back to trace it then, I think there are significant issues that need to be addressed. But I think it is overly simplistic to simply label all Protestants, all Unionists, all Loyalists as having an uncaring view on that, because that's essentially what you're saying in part, or what it implies. I think Israel has a right to exist. Israel has also a right to defend itself. I think, in addition to that, it's clear that the methods that they use to do so, and that and the manner in which they carry out those responsibilities, yes, there is obvious concern at the television pictures that we've seen. Equally, I think we're right to be concerned at the activities of Hamas. And some of the campaigns that they have waged, and the lives and the devastation that they have caused. I think all of us want to get to a situation where we can work towards achieving a more permanent settlement there. And if that is a two-state, settlement, then that's better.
I mean, it is true to say, broadly true to say, that Nationalists or Republicans have identified historically with Palestinians, mm-hmm. the oppression of the Palestinians, as they would see it, whereas the PULs, if you like, or the Loyalists have been more identified with the chosen people, which the Israelis see themselves, or at least the Jewish people see themselves as. So there are quite stark parallels. And how do you bring them together? I mean, mm-hmm. there's going to be peace talks, perhaps peace talks in Cairo. What are they going to talk about?
I think the interesting difference is, and I accept the point you make to a certain extent, I think there are clearly established political and other links between the Palestinians and Sinn Féin and Republicans and other organisations within Ireland and Northern Ireland.
Geoffrey Donsling is on the Friends of Israel in the Westminster
group. Yes, so, but that is not as significant and even the State of Israel and the Jewish people largely are not interested in developing links with other groups or countries. And I think that's one distinction that they have, that regardless of world opinion, regardless of what anybody else thinks, Israel believes in its right to exist and its right to defend itself. And it's not going to canvass world popularity or not, be it in Northern Ireland or other places. So that's a fact that we kind of sometimes overlook. That it wouldn't matter if unionism, broad unionism or Protestantism, had a particular view on it. It doesn't affect the Israeli view of themselves.
Okay. Tim?
Thanks, Noel. And may I just start by thanking the organisers of FILA for inviting me here. I really do regard it as a great privilege.
Tim, actually, before you start, yes. I just have one thing I forgot to say. Nothing I say this evening in any way represents the views of the British Broadcasting Corporation.
Yeah. Nothing that I say this evening represents the Catholic Church. They'd be very
yeah. You're wearing a colour.
They'd be very anxious to disown me, I suspect. No, I want to genuinely thank the organisers of FILA generally, not only for inviting me here this evening, but for including the issue of faith in the lives of citizens so significantly this year in the programme, because the very example that we're talking about now is an example of how important the issue of faith, culture, politics, and the link between them all is important, not only in our own situation, but at the international geopolitical level. Just then, to come to your particular comment, Fra, I have been to the Holy Land, Israel, Palestine, many, many times. I've been in the refugee camps. I've been in Gaza in 2008 under the last blockade. I've been in the West Bank. I've met some of the leading politicians on both sides over the years, and indeed church people. And I have to say my heart just breaks with what's happening. It's a failure, first and foremost, of humanity. It's a failure, ultimately, in my view, of the international community. And while I think it's important for us all to be open to the facts of every situation, and I would hope that those who predominantly support the Palestinians, I hope the nationalist Republican tradition in Northern Ireland is very open to the people that I've met in Israel, the Jewish people, who are working very hard for the rights of Palestinians, but who believe in a two-state solution, and just like you and I, feel deeply for the plight, the human plight of those in Palestine, and want to see the war ended, and they want to see some resolution.
I think that the perception would be, though, Tim, that those who support the Palestinian cause in this part of the world are very much the enemy.
Well, could I be very blunt about this? I encourage everybody to be passionately interested in the situation there, as I am myself. But let's be blunt. I don't think anybody in Israel or Palestine is particularly concerned about whether the unionist community or the nationalist community is taking sides with them particularly. I think all the elements in that conflict need the help of others, and particularly the international community. So I have preferred to try and use whatever energies I have to encourage the international community, particularly American politicians and British politicians and Europe, to get much, much more actively involved. Because here's the tragedy, in my view. The real tragedy is this, that first of all, Hamas firing rockets into populated areas of civilians is a war crime. And I can't condone that. Even if I understand the struggle, the oppression, and my God, if you go to Gaza, the desolation, the poverty, it is in every sense a totally unacceptable outrage to humanity, the way those people are being treated. And it's a David and Goliath struggle, and the Jewish people should remember the story of David and Goliath. It was the little guy who actually won in the end. But the point being that it's the international community who can do something to really do. Once this conflict is over, once this immediate situation and crisis is over, what happens? Everybody pulls back. So we would like the two governments and our peace process. And we all forget again until somebody decides the only way of getting world attention is to fire rockets.
But Tim, just to bring us back to Fred's question, are you implying there's no point in trying to bring the two sides together in this context?
I think there's no point in one community here aligning itself with flags with another community there uniquely. I think we should be deeply involved and concerned about the humanitarian and indeed the issues and the political issues, but I don't think it helps for us to take sides on either side. And I think we should be reaching out with our human hearts to everybody there, because there are Jewish people, you know, who are deeply concerned and working for peace and for human rights for Palestinians and so on. But we should also, just finally, you know, we should remember that this is a particular government in Israel, you know, that's taking a particular hardline approach, and governments can change, and the Jewish people in Israel, the Israeli people, sorry, because they're Israeli Arabs as well, who can change that. So I would prefer to work more on the macro politics, because I think that's what will really change.
Okay. Leslie.
But I respect and welcome anybody who gets involved.
Leslie.
Thank you, Noel. Thank you for the welcome to West Belfast this evening, and thanks, Fra, for the question. I'm not as well travelled as Tim, but I was on the West Bank in March just past and was shocked at the atmosphere and the living conditions there. There was a fair amount of rioting in the streets when I was there. 7 people had been killed on the Gaza Strip, so there was response across the Palestinian territories. I was tear gassed. There were plastic bullets. It was all happening. There were little kids out breaking up breeze blocks to use as ammunition, etc. It was all very familiar. The Americans were all freaking out, and those of us from Ireland were just looking out the window, feeling quite at home. But it was nevertheless shocking to observe. I find it no less shocking to sit in Northern Ireland and find that we take sides in this. And for some of the reasons that Tim has said, the situation has become far more complex than a local issue. So when Clinton came up with a roadmap for peace, he literally came up with a roadmap. So you've got Jews driving on some roads and Palestinians driving on others. This challenge of reconciliation isn't going to be easy whenever already you're living in two separate worlds. I found it staggering. I think what we hated over the years of the Troubles was people coming here and telling us who was right and who was wrong. We're quite okay if they came and told us we were right. But if they challenged our perceptions or identities, we didn't much like it. So for us to take sides seems to me to be
But the point is that we have taken sides. How do you break that down? Okay. I think that's the question.
Okay. Well, I wanted to acknowledge, first of all, that I disagree with the side taking. And I think that goes across the board, whether it's the launch of an organisation that stands with Israel or whether it's pro-Palestinian protests in West Belfast or wherever it might be. How we break it down, the conference I was at in Bethlehem was addressing that subject, and it was Palestinians who were leading the conference on that. And it was a church event. So one of the big challenges to us as church people was to look at our theology, because a whole lot of what is happening is sustained by particular theologies. And they're in America, this theology exists in America, and it exists here in Northern Ireland in terms of a fundamentalist outlook on how Jesus Christ is going to return again to the earth. So we have to, first of all, take a look at ourselves. This never breaks down unless we take a look at ourselves. So it seems to me that setting up the us and them thing is about us looking at the other before we look at ourselves. But we must then also look at the other. So over the conference, the Palestinian Christians appealed to us to listen to each other's narratives as they are trying to listen to each other's narratives, their Messianic Jews and Palestinian Christians. And then, in the light of the other narrative, to examine our own narrative. And having examined our own narrative, to then change it according to what we've heard and in light of what we've heard. And it's that relational
process.
That all process
sounds very easy. But
it sounds dead simple. And we have learned how to do some of it here. I suspect that the fact that we adopt Israeli and Palestinian flags and positions suggests that we haven't managed to correct our own narratives to the degree that we should have.
John?
Well, I think, first of all, we should take it out of orange and green politics and into an international...
But the question implies that that's where it is right now. Yeah, you agree that's where it is?
By and large, that's where it is, because we approach a lot of issues in this society based on orange and green politics, and we'll come across other issues during this debate as well. And I think people automatically fall into those categories without analysing the situation. Now, I make no apologies for supporting the Palestinian people or the people on the West Bank or the Palestinian position around the right to have a nation, the right to have human rights, the right to have basic civil rights, and the right to be able to run their own affairs. I make no apologies for that whatsoever.
Do you extend the same right to Israel, John?
Yes, I believe there is. The only solution that's going to exist, long-term solution there, is going to be a two-state solution based on the pre-1967 borders. Now, but the reason why Israel is doing what it is doing is contrary to what Donny has said. Israel do have a network of support around the world. But unlike the Palestinians, their network goes into governments, it goes into corporations, it goes into news organisations, and they're among the most powerful people in the world. And that's why Israel murdered over 1,800 civilians over this last month, because they are in a position of power which the Palestinian people do not have. So there's going to have to be a realignment of positions. The international community is going to have to accept that the Palestinian people have a right to existence. That the Palestinian
people right is enshrined in the two-state solution.
But
that admission has already been given.
Time and time again, in fact, it's widely quoted, Israel has broken more UN resolutions than any country in the world. Iraq allegedly broke two and was bombed into the Stone Age. And I'm not seeking any nation to be bombed into the Stone Age. But there's been a different approach to Israel every time because of where the positions are parallel. So there's going to have to be positions changed in this, where the international community recognise the rights of the Palestinian people as they do the rights of the Israeli people, and bring pressure to bear on the Israeli government to reach a peace deal which recognises those rights across the board. I don't see this as a religious conflict either. There's tens of thousands of Jewish people around the world who've been out on the streets demonstrating against the Israeli military and the Israeli government. If we boil this down into religious doctrine, then we'll never reach a solution to it. This is an issue around the rights of citizens, the rights of nations, to cohabit beside each other, which isn't currently being allowed to happen because one is more powerful than the other.
Let's have a few comments from the floor on this.
Thank you. My name is Jerry Carroll. I'm a city councillor, People Before Profit, and I've been involved in organising some of the protests, and I've been at some of the protests that other people have organised. And I think an important point, just on the back of what was said and what the minister said, at these protests, obviously there's a lot of people from sort of West Belfast and nationalist parts of Belfast, if you will. There's been lots of people sort of from Protestant parts of Belfast. There's been Muslims, there's been Jews. So I think it is more than just sort of quote-unquote the nationalist community who's coming to these protests. And one of the sort of the key campaigns and one of the slogans coming out of the protests in Belfast and across the world is that call for Israel to be boycotted. So I would sort of like to ask a question of both the ministers. I'd be sort of be surprised at what Minister Kennedy would say. But I'd like that question, would they support the call for Israel to be boycotted? And like I said, in Latin America, ambassadors have been expelled, and Chile have come out and said don't do deals with Israel. So I'd just like to ask that question.
Yeah, it's a good question. And we'll take a couple more. We'll come back to that. But yes, lady here in the...
Hello. I'm just wanting, it's something you'd mentioned, Noel, and maybe the panel would like, maybe even Danny would like to elaborate into why the DUP are now involved in a Friends of Israel group. It was printed on the 12th of June in the newsletter, and to find out, I know the DUP aren't here, but where the unionist stance is on that, it does sort of feel like it does.
Yeah, I have to say that I think Jeffrey Dolan's been part of that group for a long time. It's nothing to do with the recent conflict. But we'll ask Danny. And any more just on the same topic before we get there? Yes, Bill, just the gentleman in the middle of the room.
Yeah, hello. The question I would like to raise is in relation to the BBC. And since Noel has said that any comments are untrivial, this is your opportunity to have yours as well. But certainly the BBC...
I didn't say it was unattributable. I said it didn't represent the BBC.
We all heard what you said. No, this is your opportunity. Okay. But certainly the BBC have come in for a lot of criticism in relation to the coverage of the situation within Gaza. And as a person like Jerry, who's been involved in several protests outside the broadcasting house, I'll give you an example. For instance, certainly there's been a lot of protests up until, I think, the most recent one. Prior to that, there hasn't been any coverage from the local media, local BBC, in relation to those particular protests. It hasn't been mentioned in your morning show, which obviously you've run yourself. So clearly, I think it was just something that a lot of the accusations about bias have been justified. And I would like to ask the panel, and I will include you as well, Noel, if you want to have your say.
You'll not get a word from me. I'm not here to answer questions, I'm here to ask them. Danny, what about, first of all, the boycott issue? I mean, talking about international pressure, there has been a lot of international pressure on Israel. Some people would say that is what has led to the seven-day truce, or ceasefire, whatever you want to call it. But a boycott, are those useful tactics?
No. And Jerry, that'll astonish you that I would say that. But, I mean, I see no merit and I see no justification for a boycott. I think it's worth remembering that Israel is one of the few democratic countries, if not the sole democratic countries, with an electoral process, a democratically elected.
Why are you all laughing? It does have a democratic process.
Yes, I mean, you can laugh if you wish, but the Israeli, in terms of the democratic processes, I think can look beyond some of their near neighbours in terms of that. I think I don't support a boycott in any shape or form. I think it's a huge mistake. In terms of the Friends of Israel, I'm not a member of the Friends of Israel. It's
why not?
Well, I've never been asked. And, I don't have to be a member of an organisation. I do have an admiration for the people of Israel, given their tortured history, which stretches back long before, you know, the current problems, and even before the Second World War. And I think I do respectfully ask you to bear in mind that the experience of Jews and the experience of the Israeli people hasn't exactly been one that has been free from persecution or free from the threat of and the use of murder and by their enemies. So, you know, and perhaps fashioned by that, they adopt a particular attitude to their own defences.
And I just want to move along. Thank you, Danny. John and I, why don't you form a Sinn Féin Friends of Israel group? That would show that it was really, you know, you were prepared to look at both sides and take the other person's opinion, listen to the other person's opinion.
The Friends of Israel organisations that have been set up across the world and in different parliaments, and the event I think you're referring to was the Friends of Israel being set up in the Assembly. I think Jeremy Donaldson has been a member of Friends of Israel in Westminster for many, many years. Mm-hmm. It's not about protecting the rights of citizens across the Middle East. It is protecting Israel at any cost. And we've seen the cost of that over this last number of months. I do not apologise for supporting the Palestinian people or the Palestinian cause. I think it's perfectly justified that the Palestinian people want a nation. They want their nation back, and it's going to have to be based on a two-state settlement. That is a major compromise on behalf of the Palestinian people within itself.
In relation to John, why do you think Palestine has so few friends, even in the Middle East?
Can
that be blamed on the Israelis?
Because of the influence of the United States and government, which is majorly influenced by a major Zionist lobby within the United States and the American influence across the international community.
But John, the Arab states have been very happy to use the Palestinians as a thorn in the side of Israel.
I had no time during these debates of mentioned any of the Arab states as being an example of how any nation should be run. The Arab states, many of the Arab states have a lot of questions to answer themselves about how they treat their own citizens and indeed how their international responsibilities also measure up. And throughout the conflict in the Middle East, many Arab states also paid a very, very heavy price for supporting the Palestinian people. And about 4 or 5 years ago, incursions by Israel into Lebanon resulted in the death of around 4,000 civilians. So, you know, there has been pain in many, many nations throughout the Middle East because of what is going on within Israel. Okay. In relation to a boycott is a perfectly legitimate form of action for people to take.
Okay. Leslie, just moving forward, because we don't have time to deal for all of you to deal with every question. Yes, you, if we've said something wrong, go ahead. Is a microphone coming?
I don't know. Lord Balfour gave the land to... he was from England.
Yeah.
Gave the land to the Palestinians, and the Palestinians, they took the land from the Palestinians to do that as well, to make sure.
Yeah, he gave the land. The mandate was
to make sure that Israel had a good piece of land.
Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. But then after that, I think it's the Israelites. They went to the little Arab villages, they cleared them out. Yeah. Now, this is going back to, you know, what, to 60, 40, 50?
1947, I think, something like that.
Okay. And
48, they became 48. A state.
Yeah. 48. Oh, mm-hmm. Sorry.
Close.
I was a year right.
I remember that because that's my age. Anyway, so they cleared the Palestinian and took their land.
Yeah.
And nowadays, Israelis are building on Palestinian land, which is smaller and smaller. And they build on Palestinian land, they build settlements.
Yeah.
And I go there every year, mm-hmm. and I see more and more settlements.
The program continues, that's right. Yeah.
And so I think that should be part of
the... Okay, thank you for that. I just wanted to ask Les... Yeah. Just to move on to the other subject, which was about the media coverage of this, and it's not just the BBC, of course, everyone's been covering it. I mean, how do you feel that has coloured perceptions of what's going on? if it has coloured it at all.
I mean, I suppose the most worrying thing for me here is that we make this an either-or, they're right or they're wrong situation, and that sometimes the media presentation encourages sympathy without thinking about the complexity. Now, I don't think the sympathy's wrong. It is wrong to bomb children, families, to move people off their homes, to deny them the rights, to have people living in West Jerusalem with no water, no electricity. All of that is wrong. But it is equally wrong to build tunnels and launch rockets out of built-up areas so that inevitably the civilian death count will be high. That is absolutely wrong. So we need to get beyond the they're all right and they're all wrong thing, because it just simply isn't true. It was wrong that the Jewish people had to suffer the Holocaust or the Shoah. It was wrong that Palestinian people had to suffer the Nakba. People carry all of that raw memory with them. And I am pro-Palestinian in terms of the politics of the thing, but I am anti-violence. And I would prefer that when we protest against violence, because we know what it brings about. It brings about suffering and shame that people never recover from. Never recover from.
Tim, boycotts?
In relation to, this is the land, of course, that invented the boycott. I have to say, in this particular case, I would not support a boycott for two reasons. One, in real terms, in this particular case, the type of goods that you and I might boycott here in Ireland that are of Israeli origin come from the very ordinary people, particularly agricultural goods and so on, very ordinary Jewish Israelite people, when in fact the major part of the Israeli economy is weaponry and IT, information technology and so on, which of course is vital to the interests of America and Britain in particular. And this brings me back to what I think would be a much more effective way forward. And so boycotts have a danger of impacting on the innocent and also those Jewish people in Israel who are sympathetic to a solution and working actively for it. But as well as that, I don't think it's going to be particularly effective in this case. I think what would be more effective, and this situation will not change, as John has said, until America in particular and its great ally Britain decide to confront the current government in Israel. And by the way, just on the democratic issue, Hamas was elected by the people of of Gaza, as indeed Fatah was elected in the West Bank. So we just need to be very careful about that. But until America decides to, as they did, for example, and have with Britain in relation to Putin after the downing of one aeroplane, tragic and horrific as that was, in the Ukraine, putting on targeted sanctions on particular people in power is a much more effective way. And until America decides to stand up to the Israeli, and I don't use the word Jewish in a religious sense here, but the Israeli regime's interests and decides to confront them, I don't think you will get them to stop their constant breaches of international law, particularly the settlements and so on. I just make one final quick comment. People who are frightened will do reckless and unacceptable, dangerous things. It happens too in our own conflict. It has in the past. And I again appeal to you as somebody who's passionately behind the Palestinian people and their right to a state with an Israeli state, a two-state solution. But I'd ask you to bear in mind, if you go over to Israel and you talk, as I did, to a young lad who'd been in the conscripted, of course, they don't have any choice, into the Israeli army, when you talk to Israelis who are anxious about the situation of the Palestinians, you will realise that they're also very frightened, that they are living in the middle of a political cauldron with Syria, Iran, Egypt, all these not unstable, but I suspect destabilized by the West regimes. And it has never been more dangerous. And they are genuinely frightened. It is a tiny place. The first thing that shocked me when I went to Israel and Palestine was just how small it all is, you know? It's like Gaza, as you know, it's half the size of County Antrim nearly, you know, and you have 1.6 million people in there in incredibly poor circumstances. So all I'm saying is we need, I believe, that the breakthrough came here in Ireland in the north, when we started to move beyond our interest in our own rights and to try and understand the other. And there's unacceptable things that Israel and the current regime are doing, the settlements in particular, but we also need to understand the fear of a lot of the Jewish people who have a right to an Israeli state as well. And until we do that, we'll not really understand or help the situation. But I'd rather have sanctions than boycott. No. Targeted sanctions.
Thanks, Tim. I want to move on. We've had half an hour on that, and there are many other topics to discuss. I've had one from the front, so let me take this gentleman from the back. This is another subject now, yes? Thank you. I'll try and get as many of you as I can.
Hi, my name is Malik O'Hara. I'm an LGBT activist, which is lesbian, gay, bi, and trans. In other parts of these islands, the progress towards LGBT equality continues apace. When are we going to see some progress here in the north, knowing that our history is that we only achieve equality through the courts or through a Labour Secretary of State? And I would encourage Danny in his response to think about the history of the LGBT community with criminalisation and historic pathologisation of mental illness. That is the history of our community. When will we become fully fledged equal citizens in the north? Thank you.
Tim, tell us about the time you shared a Big Mac with a group of transgender citizens.
Well, as I'm sure you know, last week was Pride Week, isn't that right, in Belfast here? And I was invited onto a panel like this for one of their events. And during the course of the evening, which was generally in good humour, one of the group of young people who are trans said to me, "Oh, you talk about the importance of dignity and respect and love and kindness. Would you be willing to go to McDonald's with us with your collar on?" And I said, "Absolutely, no problem." So they come up to me after the event, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. So we all traipsed around, about myself and about 15, 20 of these young people who are trans and gay, and we went round to McDonald's on Royal Avenue, and they took a selfie of me there with them with the collar and all on. You can see it online. But
what did the bishop say, Tim?
Oh, he was delighted. The bishop was delighted. Absolutely delighted. Was that, sorry? Oh, I froze out. Actually, my shock was that they wanted to go to McDonald's. I would have a problem going. But anyway, that's another.
Anyway, serious point.
Yes. Serious point was that I actually got more out of the conversation. It was a point I made that night in the debate, you know, and I think this forum, it's important. These kind of forums are important on this issue, but it unfortunately narrows the conversation down to very specific issues. And what I enjoyed so much and learned so much from was that encounter. For an hour and a half, we had a fascinating conversation with these young people, and they asked me all sorts of questions about my faith and my position and this and that, and I talked to them about the experience of being trans, coming out as gay, and to their parents and all that, and I learned so much. I mean, this is not the first time I've spoken to people, I have friends who are gay and trans, all that kind of thing. So, anyway, what's the particular point? Yes, you asked me to tell that story, but I presume before you move to Danny, you'd like me to make a comment about this. Yes, okay. Can I say this? Not least after the discussion we've just had about Gaza. In a world that is so full of awful violence and evil, of one person against another and all the rest of it, if any two people come up to me and say they're deeply in love, they get great comfort from each other, safety, emotional support, etc., etc., well, my reaction to that is one of sensitivity, respect, for the sacredness of that relationship.
But they can't get married in a church.
But no, hold on. And this is the point I'm making. I think the danger is that we reduce the issue, the challenge to the whole community, to our whole society, to churches, the Catholic Church included. We can reduce it down to, and I don't think it's the most helpful place to start in the discussion, to the issue, say, of marriage. Now, on the specific issue of marriage, the simplest way of explaining the Catholic Church's approach to this is that we believe, both from Scripture but also from human reason, basically, to be blunt about it, you know, morality, how do you decide what's right and wrong? Part of the tradition, the Christian and the rational tradition in that regard, is in relation to sexual matters, our physical construct tells us something about the purpose of our sexual nature, and that it's orientated towards, not exclusively, the generation of children, and only a man and a woman can do that. And society has evolved over centuries to regard marriage as an institution, particularly about securing the monogamous relationship.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean it's right.
For the bringing up of children.
Doesn't mean it's right. What, just what, means that's what, the way it's
no,
been.
No, no, but I agree. But what we're actually, what we're doing here is saying that for the first time in history, we're about to say that mums and dads are totally irrelevant in the bringing up of children. That's the difference. When it comes to marriage, that's the difference.
Who has said that?
No, I'm saying that's the implication of it.
Well,
that it doesn't matter.
It's the implication
anymore.
You choose to take out of it. I mean,
well, we're,
I've never heard the LGBT sect saying that mums and dads are irrelevant.
Well, what I'm saying is that that's an implication of this. If it doesn't matter who parents children, and I think that's a huge issue for our society, by the way, generally, not just in relation to this matter, who parents children and how they parent children, if that, none of that particularly matters, then I think that's a very difficult place to be. So our concern is no... both scripturally and in terms of what we believe is in the best interest of children, that we don't support gay marriage.
Okay. But and just to be absolutely right, you're saying, sorry Tim to interrupt, but you're saying, you know, that you go to these talks, you respect
yes.
their love, you respect the relationships people have, you're saying, I love you, but well, you are sinners. Is that what you're saying?
Well, could I just point out that I am a sinner, and that in every Catholic Mass we begin by acknowledging
that
we're all sinners.
But in that specific aspect of their lives, they are committing a sin.
Well, if they're in a sexual relationship,
yeah. Okay. I just want to clear that.
That is simple. Okay. But that is not to say that we can judge ultimately the individual. We don't seek to judge the individual. All we can say is objectively certain things are right and wrong in terms of actions, okay? All but right. We leave the judgment of the individuals ultimately to God, and we come with it. I hope we come with it, but I think we have to repent of some of the influence that churches have had in our society in relation to this issue.
And repenting.
No, the churches, I'm saying.
Oh,
No, that's important. Have to repent in the way they've contributed. But like a lot of things, it wasn't just churches. It was a wider culture and so on and law and all the rest of it. So anyway, I'll wrap up with this. The critical thing is to treat each other with respect and to try and understand. And that's why this morning I was down at Cara Friend meeting again a lot of the gay and lesbian people, and particularly those involved in working with schools, so that I can help to ensure that in Catholic schools like this one, young people for whom this is all young people for whom it is an issue, are helped to respond in a constructive, helpful, positive way, and that no young person would be left feeling isolated, bullied, or otherwise in that situation.
Okay.
And I think that's a huge responsibility in people like me.
Leslie.
Okay, so thank you for...
Was that at me? Was that at me, or was that...
Well,
I'm sorry, I didn't boo anybody here. I treated them with respect.
That's disgraceful. So. No booing, thank you.
Thanks. Thanks for the question.
Especially no booing.
First of all, can I say that as a Presbyterian, I am embarrassed that I have to answer your question, because you shouldn't have to ask it. And I can see how our society has tried to put protections in place for all sorts of people, so that we can all feel equally part of this society. But clearly the experience of the LGBT community is that despite the protections, it doesn't always cash out that way. And here, yet again, we're into how we negotiate our way through the difficulty. So again, I am embarrassed to say that the Presbyterian Church has not formally engaged with the LGBT community, and we should have done so. We agreed to do so more than a year ago, but we haven't managed to find a way to do it, and we should have found a way to do it.
Just a year ago? What was the impetus for that?
It was a request that came through the General Board, which is our most representative board that meets during the year, and then came to the General Assembly. So not just in June past, but previous June, the General Assembly agreed to formally engage.
And is the lack of action on that indicative of divisions within the Assembly?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
How badly divided is it? 50-50, 75-25?
The divisions are, and you know, whether you understand how people think or not, this is how people think. Some people think we do the engagement, we listen, we learn from each other. Fine. Other people think and believe, and they believe it, I think, with the best of intentions. So try to hear it with that behind it. Is that if we formally engage with the LGBT community, we will be communicating to them that what they're doing is okay, when it's not actually okay in our view because we understand scripture to teach something different. So, and I think that's really difficult to get your head around. So this is the best intention in it, in terms of who you are as a person. I'm not suggesting, by the way, that there's no homophobia in the Presbyterian Church in Ireland, because that wouldn't be true. There's homophobia all over the place. So this is very difficult for the engagement. From a church perspective, we wouldn't be allowed, and I mean, I think therefore your question is stronger to the churches than to society, because society has made some shifts and moves. And churches, by our behaviour, have encouraged a negative attitude and, in my view, a wrong attitude to the LGBT.
And there's a long way to go, clearly.
And there's a long way.
Danny.
Malachy, thanks for the question. Appreciate that. Need to say at the outset that the Ulster Unionist Party regards these issues as matters of personal conscience, and we've been at least consistent on that. And so it's not
like the church does, you mean?
Well,
no, Tim.
No, but political. Anyway, we'll come back to that if you want. Yeah.
But I think that's a more sensible approach to it rather than having a sort of mandated.
And view. Just remind us of your own view.
And my personal view is that I am not a supporter of gay marriage. I'm active within my own church, which happens to be Presbyterian as well, and in a position of some responsibility in that congregation. But my personal view, based on my understanding of Scripture, puts me in a position where I am not in favour of gay marriage. That doesn't, in my view, make me homophobic. And any suggestion that I would be homophobic or would be capable of that would appall me, and I would be genuinely distressed if that accusation could be levelled at me. Let me say, I believe there is a difference in the law of the land and the teaching of the church. And I don't say a church, I say the church generally, because I find myself in agreement with many of the points made by Tim. And yet, on other issues of theology, Catholic Church and the Presbyterian Church would have probably severe issues, but theological issues.
How long have you got? Maybe.
Okay, but I think protections are offered within the law. Civil partnerships and the arrangements that have been entered into, yes, with a struggle and a fight, you may say, and all of that, but I do believe that they essentially provide legal support for those who wish to engage in a civil partnership. Mm. And I think that being the case, I think that affords protections to the lesbian and gay and bisexual.
I mean, I introduced the issue, Danny, but I think it's about much more, and I think, Tim, you made this point, than about much more than same-sex marriage.
Yes.
I think the question is much wider than that. It's about, you know, prejudice, which still radiates.
And there are prejudicial attitudes that we need to address.
Yeah.
And homophobia needs to be addressed.
If you're prepared to, for your own reasons, to deny complete equal right, religious and civil rights, does that not allow a breeding ground or create a breeding ground for the other kinds of prejudice which are so clearly evident?
I don't think that it ought to provide that breeding ground.
It might not ought to, or may ought not to, that expression would be, but does it?
Well, potentially it does, and there is some experience that people have.
So you accept that your attitude is partly responsible for the
I can't accept
prevalence
that.
Of homophobia in this society.
I can't accept that, but what I do say is I think there is a job of work to be done, to be undertaken by society as a whole, so that homophobia is not allowed to be prevalent.
Okay, John, I'll come to you in just a second. I just wanted to be... Sorry, Danny, yeah.
Yeah.
Have you finished?
Yeah. Yeah.